and talking with each other about all these things that had happened. While they were talking and discussing, Jesus himself came near and went with them, but their eyes were kept from recognizing him. And he said to them, "What are you discussing with each other while you walk along?" They stood still, looking sad. Then one of them, whose name was Cleopas, answered him, "Are you the only stranger in Jerusalem who does not know the things that have taken place there in these days?" And he asked them, "What things?" And they replied, "The things about Jesus of Nazareth, who was a prophet mighty in deed and word before God and all the people, and how our chief priests and leaders handed him over to be condemned to death and crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel. Yes, and besides all this, it is now the third day since these things took place. Moreover, some women of our group astounded us. They were at the tomb early this morning, and when they did not find his body there, they came back and told us that they indeed had seen a vision of angels who said that he was alive. Some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but they did not see him." And then Jesus said to them, "Oh, how foolish you are, and how slow of heart to believe all that the prophets had declared. Was it not necessary that the Messiah should suffer these things and then enter into his glory?" And then, beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them the things about himself in all the scriptures. As they came near the village to where they were going, he walked ahead as if he were going on. But they urged him strongly, saying, "Stay with us, because it is almost evening, and the day is now nearly over." So he went in to stay with them. When he was at the table with them, he took bread, blessed, and broke it, and gave it to them. Then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he vanished from their sight. And they said to each other, "Were not our hearts burning within us while he was talking to us on the road, while he was opening to us the scriptures?" That same hour they got up and returned to Jerusalem, and they found the 11 and their companions gathered together. And they were saying, "The Lord has risen indeed, and has appeared to Simon." And then they told what had happened on the road, and how he had been made known to them in the breaking of the bread. The Gospel of the Lord. I was talking to one of our parishioners who's going off to a professional conference in Boston. Boston is a nice place, particularly now that winter is finally broken. And it seems like every year Bob Packer has a professional conference in Maui. Maui's not a bad place. It's always summer there. But when the clergy go to professional conferences, it is in San Pedro. Tomorrow is the beginning of our annual spring clergy conference. All the clergy of the diocese, clergy are a hoot to hang out with for 3 days. All the clergy of our diocese will gather with our three bishops for a few days of teaching and reflection at the Crown Plaza in San Pedro. But I am somewhat heartened this year because our guest lecturer is going to be the extraordinary Walter Brueggemann, who has written 28 books, books like An Introduction to the Old Testament, The Canon, and Christian Imagination, and Truth Speaks to Power, The Countercultural Nature of Scripture, and much else. He really is terrific. And I can see that your faces are etched with jealousy. So I brought along some extra dog collars and clergy shirts to distribute to any of you who want to try and crash this party tomorrow at the Crown Plaza in San Pedro. Brueggemann really is an animated speaker. He does make the Old Testament relevant. He uses its themes to interpret our own civilization and our historical moment and the existential questions that press in on each one of us. And we need that. We need that skill set. We need that toolbox. We need people who can help us interpret our context. And to be an Episcopalian means learning how to model a way of life that isn't reductionist, that isn't limited to a materialist perspective, a way of life where wonder and mystery are the warp and woof of our daily tapestry, wherein the threads of faith weave a rich and intricate Turkish harake or Persian kashan, bright carpets on which we can fly. That's what we need if we're not going to devolve into jaded Groundhog Day sorts, traipsing through our days and months and years. Meaning, passion, transcendence, these are core to human flourishing. We heard about the road to Emmaus today. The location of that village, first century Palestine, is not known to us. Some scholars agree with the gospel that it's probably about 7 or 8 miles outside of Jerusalem. Others say it's as far as 18, but we don't really know. And Cleopas and the unnamed traveler are disanimated. They are confused. These weren't part of Christ's inner band of 12 disciples. We know all of their names, but they are reminders to us that there were a much larger group of people who followed after Jesus. Many other people who had caught Christ's vision in the world. And these too had caught that vision. It had shaped them profoundly. And they had been shaken to their core by his execution in Jerusalem. They had lost their internal center. They were headed for the hills. I don't know if you read this week that the British Prime Minister and practicing Anglican, David Cameron, got himself in a world of trouble when he called Britain a Christian nation. That sent some Brits over the edge. It created a great deal of furor. David Cameron, by calling Britain a Christian nation, put himself right down there in the gutter next to Clippers owner Donald Sterling. The former Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, came to Cameron's defense with his usual British eloquence. He said, "It is important to pick your way quite carefully through this debate. In some ways, the cultural presence is still quite strongly Christian. But it is post-Christian in the sense that habitual practice for most of the population is not taken for granted. A Christian nation can sound like a nation of committed believers, and we are not that," said the Archbishop. "Equally, we are not a nation of dedicated secularists. I think we are a lot less secular than the most optimistic members of the British Humanist Association would like us to think." Isn't that a British response? What he's trying to say is, no, nobody goes to church anymore, but we still remember that we liked it. I miss Rowan Williams. By the way, he was one of the guest speakers at a previous clergy conference in May here in San Pedro. The U.S. is not quite as post-Christian as Britain is, but we're getting there, aren't we? Millennials are terribly alienated by what passes for Christianity in the United States, which often has too neatly aligned with social reactionaries on a number of matters. The faith has left many as disanimated as Cleopas and his friends were along the road to Emmaus. Many 21st century people feel a certain dejection as well, as though they too are on a road to nowhere. We do live, in fact, in what Charles Taylor calls the secular age. And if you're up for that challenge, or if you need a doorstop, pick up that book, The Secular Age by Charles Taylor. It is a wonderful read. It will take you about 12 months. And there is much that is quite spectacular about this postmodern era in which we dwell. I might, if I were pressed to the wall, even call myself a secular Christian, a person shaped by the Western heritage of cultural, social, and philosophical struggle, eschewing dogmatisms, embracing the freedom of political discourse, of personal narrative, of varying religious perspectives. And who doesn't revel in the mix and verve of wonderful Los Angeles and our multiculturalism and our restaurants from every conceivable part of the earth? And who didn't find Donald Sterling's racism not only offensive, but puzzling? Are there still people around who think like that? Was my first response. But the underside of the secular city still needs challenged. In the secular city, function is paramount. Pragmatism trumps all. Life is seen more or less as a series of projects to be completed, a set of problems to be solved, and without much meaning beyond accumulation and hedonics. Secularism devolves to mere operationalism. Along the Emmaus Road, as Cleopas and his friend tussle through a few things, Jesus comes alongside the two travelers. They are deep in conversation, and he deepens their conversation yet further. Jesus begins to question them. He doesn't trot out a list of answers. He asks them questions. They are making every effort to tease meaning from events, even as they hightail it out of town. And Jesus joins the struggle, and he lures them to insight, a piece at a time, as they are able to receive that insight. He begins to introduce to them a transcendent perspective, and he reinterprets the ancient writings so as to bring them to bear on that particular existential moment. And as Episcopalians, we believe that this Lord is at that game yet, asking us questions, bringing us along to insights when we are able to receive them. Where two or more are gathered, when we walk along the pilgrim way, often struggling, often beset by injustice and by suffering and by the banality of life, in that very struggle together, the Lord can come alongside us. Where two or three are gathered, there I am in the midst of them. We may see the Lord perhaps no more clearly than Cleopas and his friend did. They were kept from recognizing him. But still, iron sharpens iron. God honors our quest for insight. Notice that these two fellows are not passive in this drama. When they come to their lodging, having engaged in a lot of iron sharpening, Jesus makes as though he's going to continue on his journey. And they press upon him their hospitality. They extend themselves for a stranger. And in the midst of their bereft confusion, they make a place for him at the table. And it is there, at the table, in the breaking of bread, that vision comes. And clarity arrives. They walk together along the road. They struggle in mind and heart. They extend themselves to another. And in the moment of service, a transcendent revelation of Christ with them emerges. The word for truth in the Hebrew Scriptures, as Walter Brueggemann, the Old Testament scholar, might remind the priests gathered together in days ahead in San Pedro. That word is emeth, which means something that can be counted on, something that is dependable. For the Hebrews, truth is not abstract, as it is often for us in the West, deriving so much from the Greeks. It is tangible. God is truth because God is someone upon whom one may have confidence even in the midst of tragedy, amidst bewildering circumstance, every vicissitude and change and chance, and there's plenty of it in this world that comes our way. We live forward by understanding backward. Were not our hearts burning within us when he talked to us along the road? Cleopas and his friend ask each other. My paternal grandfather owned a company called Metals Trades, and they made all kinds of things. They made the iron sculptures that are still outside Pittsburgh International Airport, and they made simple iron tubes. The making of a simple steel pipe is an amazing thing. You stand in the control module, which is, by the way, called the pulpit. And there in the control module, you see streams of molten steel pouring down the sluice where it is chopped off and grasped by another machine, by its ends, and spun so that centrifugal force opens the bar of steel from the inside out. The most important thing, my papap said, was the temperature of the metal. If it was too hot, it would fly apart. If it was too cold, it wouldn't open. You have to catch the metal at the right molten moment if it is going to bloom into a perfect tube. This is a fascinating postmodern juncture in Western history. It is a time when things may unfold that could not have unfolded in first century Palestine, or in the Greco-Roman world, or in the medieval synthesis, or the Reformation, or the Industrial Revolution, but for which this present age is uniquely prepared. And in your life, as with Cleopas and his friend, perhaps you have arrived at a juncture of new synthesis. All will not be clear from the first. During the walk, during the struggle, and the discourse, and the extension of yourself for others, and the breaking of bread, these things will bring the heart to the right temperature, to the molten moment for transcendence, for the transformation of character into useful and praiseworthy forms. Cleopas and his friend lived fully into that moment. They were fully present to the one who came alongside them obliquely along the road. What of you, this third Sunday of Easter? Will you seek for a transcendent perspective in this God-charged world? Or will you mire down in materialism? Because this is a veiled sphere, and even our epiphanies and our recognitions are fleeting. Even at table with the Lord, there is a fleeting moment of recognition, and then it all vanishes, leaving us only with conviction and work to do. And so, O Lord, from the cowardice that shrinks from insight, from the laziness that is content with settled opinion, from the arrogance that thinks that all wisdom is already in our possession, from these things, O God of truth, O God of Emeth, deliver us and come alongside on our Emmaus road and make our hearts to burn once more. Amen.